Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for braving the elements. Not quite sure what the forecast is for the rest of the evening, but it's good to see everybody turn out this evening. And I'll make a few announcements at the end about our future meetings. But it's a real pleasure for me, and I think for everybody involved in diabetes in Northern Ireland, to have Rory Holman here tonight. Professor Rory Holman is an international expert in type 2 diabetes. We have known him for a long time in Belfast, and I'll tell you more of that in a minute or two. But Rory qualified in Bristol, and then after a couple of years there, he moved to Oxford and has really been in Oxford ever since, and has built up a wonderful unit in Oxford, which, as you can see, is the diabetes trials unit. And I suppose we had seen the work that Rory was doing with the late Bob Turner in Oxford, and then the UK prospective diabetes study came along, and both the City Hospital and ourselves in the Royal became very involved in that. And it was a beautifully run study, and it was a very sociable study, because one of the things that these guys did, well, you could still do it now, but there was enough money, all was struggling for money in that trial, but within that there was always the opportunity to go to Oxford, and David Haddon was on the steering committee for the main study, and I was privileged to be on the blood pressure arm of the study. So when you went over for the day to look at what was happening and to see what was happening, Rory and Bob always had gone out and bought a cake or chocolate eclairs. There was always something waiting for you when you arrived there, and you were always made very, very welcome. And as you know, it was a really seminal study in diabetes. And then after that, he's gone on to do a variety of other studies, and I'm not going to steal your thunder, because I think you'll probably mention more of those, Rory, as time goes on in your talk tonight. But it's absolutely lovely that you've honoured us at the Ulster Medical Society by coming along, and we're looking forward to what you're going to say. The other thing that some people here will have heard of and other people won't have heard of is a thing called the Oxford Risk Engine. I don't know whether there's a slide on that, but you can put in the data on people with diabetes and see what their vascular risk is, and this has all come out of that study so capably run from Oxford, and with so many people in the UK in the diabetes field happy to be involved in that, as smaller centres being involved in the work. So we're looking forward to your talk very much indeed, and thank you very much for coming. So let's give a good welcome to Rory Holman.
So thank you, Bru, for that delightful introduction. You're too kind. It's a real honour for me to be here today and to meet with so many people who've worked with us in the past, in the long time past and the more recent past. We continue to have clinical trials that still use centres here in the north and in the south. And that old camaraderie where you could do research on a one-to-one basis with like-minded positions still exists, but it's tough. And the newer generation is very different, something I was talking to Bru about on the way here. But enough of that. My task tonight is to address this issue, which has deviled my footsteps for a long time, which is, does glucose lowering really have an impact on cardiovascular disease? And the world was divided over this. The cardiologists were not impressed with the glucose doctors, and the glucose doctors, I think, were probably over-impressed with what they might achieve, and somewhere in the middle lies the truth. So the issues about glucose and type 2 diabetes in particular are that it is the genesis of most of the risk for most of the complications that they have, over and above the background vascular risk that everybody has. So clearly there are a number of risk factors, but if you're diabetic, you are at higher risk than the peer group, and that risk, we believe, is generated largely by the glucose. And I've just put up the microvascular risks because we now see much less of this. After UKPDS and the general move to tighten guidelines, in my clinic, we rarely, if ever, now see those end-stage complications. We don't have the blind amputees wandering around any longer. So we are amazingly better off. But there is a warning, and I'll say it now, that is, If we're successful in prolonging life for our patients, which I believe we are, then their exposure to glucose over the years will be longer, and so the need to be vigilant about A1C is actually more important. I think we've been lulled into a sense of false security. Average A1Cs have dropped quite nicely, but as you know, it's a progressive disorder, and you have to keep adding therapies, and you have to monitor and adjust, and it's very easy to just let things slide, and then we'll be back to complications. But the issue is that over 3/4 of our patients die from vascular disease, and that is the issue that we are trying to tackle. If we lower cholesterol, if we improve blood pressure, and we tackle A1C to a reasonable extent, you still do not get the risk for our patients back to their peer group. The residual risk is still higher. And that may be the diabetic status. It may be that we need to treat the risk factors even greater. You'll have seen that the guideline for LDL cholesterol has dropped again. And we keep tightening these, and we move ahead of the general population for our diabetics in order that we can try and redress that balance. So what are the modifiable risk factors? Well, I've mentioned most of them already, but I put this slide up for David because this was a slide that the late Robert Turner was very keen on. This was an analysis that was done actually before we had the results of UKPDS. This is epidemiology. And it just picks out the statistically independent modifiable risk factors. And they're just in order of statistical significance. And of course, there are other risks like age and gender and things that we cannot change so easily. But this set of risk factors, the smoking, the blood pressure, the HDL and the LDL cholesterol, were known as the deadly quartet. Or if you're down in Australia, they call it the awesome foursome, which I've just come back from Melbourne. That's what they were telling me. But what we found was that HbA1c was right in the middle here as a very strong independent predictor of cardiovascular risk. And so Robert immediately renamed this the deadly quintet. And so that's what it became known as. And of course, the problem with epidemiology is that it shows you a relationship, but it doesn't tell you if it's causal. And of course, this is now proven, LDL cholesterol lowering unequivocally. It's magic. You actually recover the degree of risk that the epidemiology predicts if you drop the LDL cholesterol by a set amount. HDL cholesterol, the jury's still out. We've had an abortive major trial that's run into problems, but there's still pretty good evidence that if we could raise HDL cholesterol, we might get benefit. That's an area that we're still exploring. Blood pressure, again, completely solved. Blood pressure lowering, unequivocally beneficial. And here's A1C in the middle was perhaps the earliest thing we were looking at, has taken the longest to get a handle on. So what is the relationship of A1C to risk? This is, again, UKPDS data. This was published at the same time as the main trial results, but this is epidemiology. This is an analysis done by Irene Stratton, and what it does is it takes the updated mean A1C. We spend a lot of time, I think incorrectly, in many of our trials, achieving an A1C, often at a very short period. You'll see everything from the drug companies like 26 weeks or even 6 months. Our patients live, hopefully, 20, 30 years. So what I'm interested in is glucose exposure over time. So it's A1C times time, and that's what this is. It's the average exposure in the trial. And so what Irene did was to look at the different levels of glucose exposure against the ratio or the hazard ratio for coronary heart disease. And you can see this goes from about 1 for the lowest A1C exposure, really quite high, 2 to 3 times higher up here. And what Irene calculated was that if you drop the A1C by 1%, anywhere on this line, you would buy a 14% reduction in risk. So that may doesn't sound a lot, but 2% would be 28% reduction, getting to be quite statin-like. So there was hope here that there might be benefit. And of course, the UKPDS glucose results are well known to all of us. The headline composite was significant. Macrovascular disease, remember there was only a modest difference in the trial, 0.9%, not a huge difference, about what you can achieve with most oral agents up front. But it was a quarter reduction in microvascular disease, a very strong relationship. But here for myocardial infarction, the risk reduction we got was almost exactly what Irene would have predicted, 16%, 14%. The problem was it didn't achieve conventional statistical significance. If that value had been 0.49, the world would have been different because it would have been accepted by the cognoscenti that it was a definite improvement and we'd have moved on. As it was, we had to say in the paper quite correctly that there was no statistical significant result, and we had to then live another 10 years while other trials were done to see if we could prove the point. So here's one of those trials. It took about 10 years for all these trials to come. There's this huge gap when all we had was UKPDS data. And it was used extensively and mostly correctly, although not always. But there were no other trials. Nobody was going to do an outcome trial because it was too complicated and too expensive. And then suddenly we had three at once. So this is the ADVANCE trial. This is the trial that was done by or funded by Servier. And it was a 2x2 factorial design. So what they were looking at was both glucose lowering and blood pressure lowering. And I'm only going to talk about the glucose lowering arm at the moment. And they had a target of less than 6.5 or 6.5 or below. And they were using a sulfonylurea-based approach as the arm that would have the lower glucose. And they did have two co-primary endpoints. One was macrovascular, which was MI stroke or CV death. But they also had a microvascular endpoint. This was worsening renal function or eye disease. Actually, they weren't terribly solid endpoints. UKPDS actually had hard microvascular endpoints, renal failure, laser photocoagulation, or vitreous hemorrhage. Many of the more recent trials are using changes in albumin status or changes in creatinine, which are fine, but they're surrogates. They're not actual complications. And so what they found was firstly, they had a trouble getting the A1C to separate. I was actually on the DSMB for this trial, and for those of you that are on DSMBs, it's very frustrating to watch a trial that's not going the right way. So we were really panicking about here a year in, because they're not getting anywhere near 6.5, which was their target. The standard arm was improving as well, and so we dispatched Herzl Gerstein to the Far East to give pep talks on how to increase the intensity of treatment, and this is, I call, the Gerstein effect, because there it is. And they achieved a very credible difference at the end of the trial, 7.3 against 6.5. But going back to my point earlier, the average difference over the trial was only 0.75 percentage point, 0.67. And so it wasn't the biggest separation that you might have liked to have seen. But for the microvascular outcome, they had a 14% risk reduction, 0.01, highly significant, median follow-up 5 years, not as long as UKPDS, but I think unequivocal separation. So if you look at this in context of UKPDS, we had a 25% risk reduction for a 0.9% difference in A1C. This is a smaller difference in A1C and a smaller risk reduction, but I think it's pretty much in line. It reflects the epidemiology. So this now is the second pivotal trial to show that lowering glucose lowers microvascular risk, and we've waited a long time for it, but it's nice. It fits, no problems. The difficulty was when you looked at macrovascular outcome, the risk reduction was 6%, but it wasn't even beginning to look significant. And there are some people who say, but yes, if you look here, the lines are separating. And there is some substance to that, because in UKPDS and in DCCT, the type 1s, it took 4 or 5 years before we began to see separation in our macrovascular endpoint line. So if you're into glucose control and reduction of CV disease, you're in for the long term. But nonetheless, this effect was not large enough in this number of patients, and don't forget they had 10,000 plus patients, to demonstrate a significant difference. BADT was a much smaller trial. It's an American trial. It's the Veterans Affairs Diabetes Trial, less than 2,000 patients. And this had a very aggressive goal, less than 6% A1C. And they were taking a comparator group that should have been between 8 and 9. That should be the other way around, that symbol. The problem for me was this is almost unethical after the UKPDS and certainly after the VADT results, allowing people for several years to have glucoses that high was probably not appropriate. But it did allow them to get a very large separation. It did allow them potentially to see a larger effect. And this is the effect they saw. They were much quicker to achieve their lower value. They didn't get below 6. Their median here was 6.9%. And the difference was obviously much larger because they allowed the less intensive group more latitude. And so they achieved and maintained a difference. Now, I'm actually quite impressed by this. These people are end-stage diabetes. They've had it for years. They're more elderly people. They have comorbidities. They have risk factors. And if you tell me that, you know, they managed to achieve 6.9% for that length of time, I think that's quite impressive. It does show that with diligence, we can actually maintain the A1C. But what happened in terms of the results? Well, their primary outcome was only cardiovascular, and here we see a 12% risk reduction, but again, nowhere near significant. Again, a follow-up of around 5 years plus median. These are the proportions of people with the events. So it's a risk reduction, but it's not significant. They did do this exploratory analysis. This is an old slide. I don't have their more recent version of this. But this was an interesting, if somewhat complicated, statistical analysis. So I'll just explain what they did. They had a view that the longer you had diabetes, perhaps the more refractory you were to risk reduction, that it would be more difficult with glucose lowering to gain benefit, and that if you were early in your diabetic history, you might see more benefit. So they did this analysis, which shows the hazard ratio against the length of time people had been known to have diabetes. And what it shows is that in the early years of diabetes, the hazard ratio is less than one. In other words, you're seeing benefit. And after about 15 years, it crosses the line and you're seeing worsening. Now, bearing in mind the data from the ACCORD study, which we'll talk about in a moment, this seemed to fit with the view that most people had. But it is a model, it's not real data, it's a simulation. But it is suggesting that there might be something that relates to the length of time you had diabetes. And it plays to the notion that if you're going to treat them, you treat early. You don't wait till they're 10 years down the line and their A1Cs are already too high. The benefit is going to be maximized by starting at the earliest time. So that brings us to ACCORD, which really was a major study. This study, I've heard costed differently. I'm told $500 million is probably the actual cost of this study. And they took a cardiology view. This study was run largely by cardiologists, although Herzl Gerstein was one of the principal investigators. And the view was, because I was actually involved in some of the design work, that if glucose lowering is important, then we should actually do it to our best ability and prove the point once and for all. There was a great deal of frustration that UKPDS had this equivocal answer. So they set up a study which was a double 2x2 factorial design. The main part of the trial were 10,000 patients, 10,250 as you can see, randomized either to intensive glucose lowering, which was less than 6%, same target as VADT, or a more reasonable higher value between 7 and 7.9. And then within the trial, half the patients were also randomized to two levels of blood pressure lowering, less than 120, less than 140, and the other half were randomized to two lipid lowering strategies. One was statin alone, and the other, they got a statin plus a fibrate. And of course, this was double blind, this part here, The rest was open label. And the study was set up and ran and recruited. There was a 1,000-patient trial, a pilot trial. They showed they could do it, and then the NIH gave them the money together with industry to do the rest of the trial. And they actually did this in quite good time. And this is the glycemic control they obtained very quickly. They managed to get the intensive arm down not below 6 on average, but to 6.4. Very similar to the advanced people, but these were more severely diabetic people on more therapy. And again, I demonstrate that they were able to achieve and maintain A1C over 5 or 6 years, showing that if you have the money, the resource, and the will, you can actually do it. And their other arm, the comparator arm, was slap in the middle of their constrained value, 7 to 7.9. So as a trial, this was extremely well done, and they achieved exactly what they wanted to do, which is to contrast two levels of glucose control over a decent period of time. And the primary cardiovascular outcome, which was actually looking good, was a 10% risk reduction with the suggestion of the separation from the 4 to 5 year point onwards didn't achieve significance. And the key here is the median follow-up was 3.5 years. As you know, the study was stopped by the DSMB because of an adverse effect on cardiovascular death. But for the actual outcome of the study, it was all going the right way. And this is why they stopped the study. There was a hazard ratio, a 22% increase in risk. You can see here the separations from about 2 years onwards. The intensive therapy arm, the ones with the lower glucoses, were dying more frequently. And this has really put the cat amongst the pigeons. A couple of things to say. The actual event rates in this study are some of the lowest I've ever seen. The actual rate of deaths in this group is lower than for the Northern England non-diabetic population. It is amazing how well controlled they were and how few events they had. But when you do the comparison, then the risk is higher of sudden death or death after MI. So we were left with a conundrum. Well, let me just tell you a little bit about that, because there are papers coming out now that have explored that conundrum and looked at it. The worry when the study reported was that pushing people to low A1Cs was harmful, and people were dying because of hyperglycemia by attempts to get their glucoses below 6. In fact, the people who were dying to excess had the higher A1Cs, but they were more difficult to control. And it does appear that the people who had the near normal A1Cs had no increase in risk. That's now quite clear. So if you could achieve and get a low A1C, that's great and it's not harmful. But if you're struggling with a high A1C and you keep adding therapies and you're not getting anywhere, it's that group of people who are hard to identify, and they just now doing the analysis to try and predict who those people are, where you run into problems. And they're probably having highly variable glucoses in the day. They probably are having hyperglycemia and awareness. They probably are having sympathetic overdrive, which gives them either arrhythmias or a bad response to an MI. So the risk of an MI in the lower A1C patients was less, but if you had an MI, the case fatality was high. So that's why the sympathetic overdrive, hyperglycemia and awareness story, I think, has some traction. So were these four studies now out there, the UKPDS, VAT, Advance and Accord, people immediately began to say, well, let's put the data together and see if we can get an answer. And the first paper out of the stocks was by Naveed Sattar with Ray from Cambridge, and they put together five studies. They added proactive for reasons which I've never quite understood. Here are the data. UKPDS, Advanced VAT and Accord. This is the coronary heart disease analysis. And for some reason, I think they mistakenly took proactive to be a study of intensive versus less intensive glucose lowering. And of course, it was a study of addition of pioglitazone to people with end-stage diabetes. And pioglitazone does way more than just changing the glucose. It was a modestly significant study. The secondary endpoint was significant, not the primary. It really doesn't belong in this meta-analysis, but as you'll see, it doesn't really cloud the issue. So what they did is they took the published data from these studies. They just looked at event rates. They didn't look at person years. And in the meta-analysis, they had a 15% risk reduction for coronary heart disease, for, on average, about a 1% A1C difference. And this is significant. So we go right back to where I started, and where Irene Stratton predicted that if you drop the A1C by about 1%, you get about a 14% risk reduction. Here it is. It took this number of patients to see it, and it's significant. We ourselves went on and did what we think is a slightly more correct analysis of these data. This is the control group. This is a group of people who've come together. You'll see the authors here. Fiona Turnbull from the MRC in Sydney is the first author here. But the others are the principal investigators from the four studies. And the four studies got together, we sat down, and we wrote an analysis plan to say, let's pool our respective data. And what this showed in this prospective planned study was that we actually significantly showed a reduction of macrovascular events over about 4.4 years. Now, the difference between this and the Ray analysis is that we had access to the real data, so that was helpful. And we also, for UKPDS, only used the first 5 years. So it was a bit odd to put a 20-year study against three studies, which were about 5 years on average, because all sorts of effects are different. So what happened for us was here for major cardiovascular events. You can see the four studies, you can see the analysis, and here again we have a significant 9% risk reduction. And this is for major cardiovascular events, sudden death, non-fatal MI, and non-fatal stroke. For those of you that are the statisticians here, this figure at the bottom, the I-squared value, this is a measure of the variability of the data that's coming from the different studies. If you look here for each of the four studies, they're all lined up with the overall one. There's not much scatter. The closer this value is to zero, the more likely it is that you're getting the same information from the studies you combined. The higher that number, and 50 is like bad news, 100 is a disaster, means that you can't really combine them. So meta-analysis is a health warning. If you don't see a good I-squared value, then you shouldn't be believing the data. So here we've got it for that. This is for myocardial infarction, just fatal and non-fatal MI. Again, a 15% risk reduction. Again, it matches exactly the Ray analysis and what Irene predicted. Again, the I-squared value is close to zero. So our view, and I think many other people now, agree that a modest degree of benefit for cardiovascular disease, particularly if you start early, is available from A1C lowering. It's not going to replace lipid treatment, it's not going to replace blood pressure, but remember, our patients remain at excess risk. We have to go the extra mile, and glucose lowering is going to be helpful. This is all-cause mortality, and again, there isn't in this analysis, a significant difference. The hazard ratio is 1.04, but if you look at the I-squared, it's getting perilously close to 50%. This is suggesting that there is something odd about the study. So when you look, three of them line up, and here's ACCORD, the outlier. Something about the way the ACCORD study was run led to the difference, and I think we now believe it was the aggressiveness with the combination of therapies where they were trying to treat people with intractably high A1Cs just by throwing more and more treatment at them that led that group to have this high risk of sudden death. So for cardiovascular death, the reason they stopped the ACCORD study, you can see now the I-squared value is 65. This really is not an acceptable meta-analysis. And we now begin to see that the ACCORD group are also out here. And the ACCORD and the VADT group and the ACCORD are looking at similar analyses in their data to try and pick out these people who did so badly. And I think the message is for people who can achieve reasonable A1Cs without difficulty or without multiple therapies having to be added in short succession, that's fine. But we need to be cautious about people who've got atherosclerosis and are proving difficult to bring down and you're having to add so many therapies. We did have a quick look and see if there was anything that might influence the decision. So we looked at gender and age and starting A1C. And here these are the effect sizes. They do not differ for any of these subgroups. This is the p-value for heterogeneity. What this is telling us, since none of them are significant, is that it doesn't matter whether your A1C is high or low to start with, whether you're male or female, or your age. It doesn't influence the results of the meta-analysis. So it's one size fits all. That's very comforting. We looked at duration of diabetes. In this analysis, it made no difference. We looked at presence or absence of microvascular disease. Makes no difference. But the one that was interesting was if you had prior macrovascular disease, you did not do as well. In fact, you got no benefit compared to people who did not have macrovascular disease. So this is supporting the notion that if you're going to go for glucose lowering for benefit for atherosclerosis, you better start early. And that people who have atherosclerosis may be either more resistant to the benefit or may actually be more at risk of the sudden death. So I want to move on for a few minutes onto UKPDS, because while all these other trials were going on, with the help of some of the people in this room, we continued to monitor all the patients who were in our trial to start with. So in 1997, before we reported the data, we had already moved all the survivors into a follow-up for 10 years. Over the that point, period of time, we increased the follow-up to 17 years average on total, and 44% of patients had died by then. This just reminds us how serious a disease this is. These people were 53 years of age on average. 17 years later, nearly half of them had died. It's a salutary statistic. So what we then did was we repeated the analysis that we had done at the end of the trial. People who had originally been intensive, we compared them with those who had originally been conventional. And of course, during this 10 years, there was no longer any separation. We didn't achieve different treatment goals. We didn't treat them in any different way. Everybody was sent back to their general practitioner or standard clinic and got the same treatment. And I can prove that because if we look at the different therapies by the randomized groups, you can see the proportions of people who got single therapy, diet, or combinations is identical. So after the trial, everybody sort of merged into a similar arrangement for their care. And their A1Cs, which were different at the end of the trial, this is 1997, significant difference. Remember, we had about a 0.9% difference overall. Within 1 year, the trial stopping, they had become identical. And they remain identical for the rest of our follow-up period where we have the data. This is just a nice thing here that after the guidelines changed, then the A1C changed. And don't forget, in UKPDS, we weren't allowed to use combination therapy unless people really did fail. So once it was introduced, then of course you could improve their A1Cs. So then we looked at what happened to the results of the trial. This is 1997. This is the 12% risk reduction that we saw for the endpoint, highly significant. And 10 years later, it's not changed. It's still 9%, still significant, even though the groups are identical. And we nicknamed this the legacy effect, an enduring benefit of early treatment. So we're not suggesting you treat people for 10 years and stop. We're saying that the first 10 years carries forward to give you additional benefit. And we would assume that if we had continued to keep the group separate, we would have actually seen additional benefit. But it's interesting that the first 10 years carries on performing. We thought maybe after 2 or 3 years we'd lose the effect, but it's still there. For microvascular disease, remember, it's a 1/4 risk reduction. It's still 1/4 10 years later, almost identical. So again, a major benefit from starting early. And what you don't want to do is to wait 10 years and then begin treatment, because you'll never recapture this early benefit. But this was the stunning result. Remember our 16% risk reduction, that p-value that was just the wrong side of 0.5? it hasn't changed. The effect size is still 15%, but now with additional events, we have the power to show it's statistically significant. So as well as the meta-analysis I've shown you, which I think shows that the first 5 years does make a difference, although modestly, we're now showing that in the long term, by this extension of the UKPDS, you can also see additional benefit for glucose lowering with respect to myocardial infarction. And the real surprise was that all-cause mortality, which is very difficult to affect, because sadly we all die of something, it's called competing risks. If you don't die from a heart attack, then the cancer gets you. So reducing all-cause mortality is a holy grail that's a difficult one. But here, a sort of 6% trend, which nobody took any notice of at the end of the trial, is now a 13%, we've doubled the risk reduction, highly significant. And that's because we're extending life by not having the heart attacks. Eventually, of course, the cancers will catch up, but for now, we're really getting benefit. So the results of the extension of the UKPDS confirmed what we saw at the end of the trial. 10 years later, we're seeing the same benefits that we saw, but now we've got emerging benefit for myocardial infarction and for all-cause mortality. So I think at that point it's quite clear that we do have macrovascular benefit. And just very briefly, there's this nice slide from the DCCT where they followed their patients, type 1, after the end of the trial. They're following them out, and their 10-year follow-up data showed a very dramatic 42% risk reduction for cardiovascular outcome, almost exactly what we predicted in a meta-analysis of type 1 patients 3 years ago in the American Heart Journal, suggesting that in a group of people who have less impact from other risk factors, because they tend not to have the same issues with blood pressure and lipids at a younger age, the glucose effect is more dramatic. So I'll skip over blood pressure because I just wanted to talk to you about a couple of quick trials. The unanswered question for me is this issue of postprandial glucose. And this is data from the DECODE study. This is a massive epidemiologic analysis of many studies which had followed people who'd had oral glucose tolerance tests. And this is Jaakko Tuulimeto from Finland is the first author here. And what he showed was that if you looked at fasting glucose as low, middle, and high values against the risk of mortality, there is really not much in relation as you step up the fasting glucose. Now, this isn't what you see with pregnancy outcomes, David, but for all-cause mortality, fasting glucose is not a strong predictor. But if you look at the two-hour glucoses, at whatever level you're fasting glucose, there is a strong ramp-up. And this has led to the suggestion that something about postprandial dysmetabolism is the missing link, this bit of the residual risk for type 2 patients that we haven't managed to get into. It may be why, when we treat people to the best of our ability, they still have a higher risk than they should have compared to their peer group. And there was a study in, it was running from Canada, but it was actually in Spain and Israel as well. The Stop-Nidham study treated people with ACABOs, which specifically reduces glucose after meals. That's all it does. It inhibits the absorption of glucose, so it's a very simple method. And in this study, which actually showed a reduction of the risk of type 2 diabetes, because it was done in IGT patients, they also looked at the cardiovascular outcome, and they had a highly significant risk reduction with a postprandial glucose lowering drug. The only problem is it had no power, there are only about 30 events, but it looked impressive. So we have gone on and we've actually set up a trial with Rob Califf from Duke, Steve Hafner from Texas, and John McMurray from Glasgow here, although a good Irishman, as I'm sure you know. And what we did was, this is an 8-year study, and we looked at two treatments. We compared an angiotensin receptor blocker in one arm of the trial, and then the other, the one that's of interest to us today, is we use nateglanide, a very rapid-acting agent that increases insulin just after meals, reduces glucose after meals, and does almost nothing else. And that study is 8 years follow-up, and we are showing here the change in the glucose levels, about a 30% risk reduction. You can can do this with an eteglinide quite easily, very few side effects, not much risk of hypoglycemia. And also from the VALUE study, which was a study of valsartan, the agent we used in this, there was a surprise result which showed a 23% risk reduction of the risk of type 2 diabetes. So this study, looking at two completely different methods, thinks we can reduce both diabetes risk, but also it's powered for cardiovascular outcomes. It's 9,500 patients. We will look at time to progression of diabetes. We will look at a very hard cardiovascular outcome and an extended one. And this study is being presented March the 14th. So we will be at the ACC, and this is, if you could get to this meeting, which is Atlanta, you'll see there's something interesting going on. We have our results here, which will be published on the same day, but also the two other arms of the ACCORD study will be there. So the lipid arm, which we showed you, they carried on that part of the study, and those data are now ready to present. And the blood pressure arm, remember it was 120 against 140, they're also presenting. So this is going to be an exciting Sunday morning. I have no idea what their results are. I know what mine are, but I'm not allowed to tell you or I'd have to kill you. But the answer is we are hoping to look at the conundrum of the missing link, which is the postprandial glucose. And just to say, we have a second postprandial glucose study. We actually took the Acabose molecule and we were requested by the Chinese, who have a huge problem with diabetes, where Acabose or alpha glucosidase inhibitors are their number one drug for diabetes. We are actually looking at a cardiovascular intervention trial there, but that won't report for another 5 or 6 years. So I'll skip over that one. The messages I wanted to leave you with, and I hope I've convinced you, but I'm prepared to answer the questions now, is that we can reduce microvascular risk, but I now firmly believe there's a modest but worthwhile drop in microvascular complications. I'm also impressed that if you make the effort and the trials people did, you can achieve lower A1Cs and maintain them. Sometimes in clinic it looks like a hopeless job, but actually it can be done. And I've shown you that if you improve glucose earlier, then you get longer term benefits. So we have to tackle this aggressively from the get-go. And the issue of the postprandial glucose, the jury's out. We have two studies by two different methods. If there is this additional benefit to be had, we'll tell you. If not, then some of the younger folks are going to have to do the next trial, because I'll have to stop at that point. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a lovely talk and for all that hard work. I'm sure there'll be loads of questions. Who's going to start?
Yeah, please.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. You skipped over blood pressure.
Yeah.
And what I'd like to know is how in all these trials do they ensure that the confounding effect of blood pressure and outcome is actually not there? I wonder if you could say a bit more.
Oh, sure. It's as a trialist, it's one of our nightmares. Is you can either go for a trial where you control everything, which is what ACCORD did. They had the money and the resources and the ability to control everything. So they supplied the drugs and they actually treated the patients themselves. Or you have to have a more hands-off approach where, by and large, you leave the other risk factors to be treated by the general practitioner or the clinic concerned. And the value there is that in a randomized trial, the blood pressures, although they may not be ideal, will be almost identical in the two arms of the trial. They don't confound the result. But what you have to be careful is that they are treated pretty reasonably. You don't want a trial in, let's say, a third world setting where the blood pressures are sky high, because that isn't a real test. So you have to have reasonable blood pressure. But if you get the blood pressure to sort of approaching guideline, it won't confound the result of your own trial.
And all the studies show that.
They do. So one of the things when you look at a study, you do look at that in the two arms. There are examples where things don't always work as they should do. So, for instance, I was one of the co-PIs on the DREAM trial. This was a study we did with Salim Youssef and Herzl Gerstein where we looked in IGT patients and treated them with rosiglitazone, a very effective TZD, although one that's subject to a lot of interesting media pressure at the moment. And we were able to reduce the diabetes onset rate by 60%. But one of the side effects that's in the paper but not often commented on is rosiglitazone raises LDL. And what we found was in that arm of the study, more people had statins because the good doctors looking after these patients saw the higher LDLs and gave a statin. And of course, statin reduces cardiovascular risk. So that's a very good example of confounding. It's a brilliant question, and you have to be very careful when you look at these studies because sometimes the people who report them are not perhaps as honest as they might be.
Rory, if we accept that lowering blood glucose reduces microvascular risk, what about some of the more sort of subtle effects within that that you've been saying, telling us about, translating that towards the writing of guidelines? Are we at the stage where, for example, there's maybe better effect early on is should be put into guidelines that we currently use?
Yep, I think... For a number of reasons, early control is to be desired. First, it's a lot easier to achieve control earlier. And I'd like to see preventing escape of A1Cs as opposed to heroic rescues at the end of the day. In the studies that had the problem, particularly the Accord, the reason they went for the patients of the sort that were included in the study was they wanted people who were likely to have heart attacks. They wanted a high event rate to get the power of the study. And I think that's what tripped them up. They took people with hardened arteries, prior myocardial infarctions, and then tried to get their A1Cs completely normal. So I think there's a very clear message here is that early on, treatment, even if it's a aggressive appears to be relatively safe to buy additional benefits. But if you've had diabetes for many years and you have not achieved good control and you have difficulty achieving it when you come back to it, I think that's a danger signal. I'd say one more thing, and I think it was implied by your question, and it's a very good question. We talk about guidelines and numbers, and I think I'm not a fan of targets. I find them very difficult. They're great for public health. They're great for quickly informing a group of people where they might want to aim for, but you have to individualize it. And so if I see somebody in the clinic who's got an A1C of, let's say, 7.1%, our guidelines say it should be 6.5, so, you know, if the registrar's here, you've got that patient in front of you. If everything else is going swimmingly well with that patient, you have to ask what is the actual benefit of getting another 0.6% of A1C lowering against the cost to their quality of life, the cost of the drugs, the impact of the finger pricking and the rest of it. And I think that's where we should be having the discussion. Clearly, A1Cs above 8 are really problematic because of the microvascular disease. Once you get down to 7 and below, the actual risk of microvascular disease is now becoming quite small. So the incremental benefit of pushing harder has to be balanced against the effort. And sometimes we are glucose-centric. We know there are other things. They're still smoking. Their blood pressure is still not a goal. There are other things we could be doing with that patient. They don't exercise. They're overweight. But there we are, hammering on our diabetes, giving an extra 10 units of insulin and complaining because they don't do enough finger pricking. And I just think that's where the reality check comes in. In the complexity of being a person with diabetes, it is a major impact on their lives. You know, and we just in the clinic are seen as negative people coming along, berating them because they haven't got their A1C down. If their A1C hasn't gone up, that's actually a victory because it's a progressive disease. And so I just worry sometimes that targets have unintended consequences. We have a government in the UK, as you know, that has as a result of their targeting, I'm not a political person, but it has led to the law of unintended consequences. So, you know, in one of our local hospitals where the rule was you mustn't be on a trolley or a gurney for more than 4 hours, the managers came and took the wheels off and said they were in a bed. And that solved the problem. It's very creative, but didn't make a difference. So my point to you is, yep, guidelines are helpful for setting the wider strategy, but it's always a person that you need to be talking to and coming to a deal with them as to what they can do to achieve it. And I like, you mentioned the risk engine. We actually use the risk engine as an example. So we show them their risk. We lower the A1C by 0.5%, show them the risk they will achieve, or we change their lipids, or we change their blood pressure, and then we have a dialogue about which one do you want to buy this week.
Rory, it's always a pleasure to listen to you, and I always am amazed that, as Oliver Goldsmith said, that one small head could carry all he knew, because you are able to give us the facts in all of these studies at the same time, which any normal person takes ages to get to the bottom of. So thank you very much for doing that. Can I ask you one question, and I'm not sure there is an answer. You were a little gloomy about the end effect of all these studies was that we were all going to die of cancer. There is a suggestion that metformin might actually be something which reduces cancer risk. What do you think of that?
I think it's a very real possibility. So we now know that metformin works through AMP kinase with upstream LKB1, a tumor gene. We looked in UKPDS, we do see a trend to benefit, not significant, and we have now looked in a series of epidemiology studies. So the best data, if you want to look at it, are the Dundee DARTS data set and also the Saskatchewan database, the Canadian Big Health Board, and both of those show that metformin not only reduces cardiovascular risk, but also cancer risk. So with Richard Stevens, who I think you know, who did the risk engine with me, we're just doing a meta-analysis of all the big studies where people have been randomized to metformin to look at the cancer risk, and the genetic folks are getting on board with us. I've applied to the HTA for money with Nick Wareham from Cambridge to run a 10,000-patient study where we're going to randomize people with IGT who are being discovered through the new vascular screening program the government's put in place. There's a whole load of people now appearing with IGT. We don't know what to do with them because they're being tested because the government wants them tested, but there's no treatment for IGT other than diet and exercise. So we're going to randomize them double-blind to metformin. And the two co-primary outcomes, David, are heart disease and cancer. So I firmly believe there's benefit to be had there.
Rory, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Quite a lot of younger people here and quite a lot of people from endocrinology and diabetes training, and it's just wonderful to see so many young people coming to the Ulster Medical Society. You're embarking now, you've done all of these trials, research governance can seem overwhelming at times, and folks in our own unit who've done this have found it sometimes overwhelming. Give us the secret of your ability to persist with that and to get through it and to say, I'm just David, I'm going to do another 10,000 patient trial that will randomize the metformin, because this is what we need our younger people to have, the ability to do these sort of studies despite the difficulties that people are having with research. What's the secret?
Well, it's all about networking and coming to talk to people like me. That's the thing you need to be doing. The problem now, quite rightly, is research has been put on a very regulated footing because clearly there were bad examples of research, biased research, inappropriately managed research, research that was never reported for all sorts of reasons. So we've had to clean up our act and get registered, and that brings with it, I'm afraid, huge amounts of bureaucracy. So now we have to work together. Because it's so costly to do that, you need trials units like mine. There are several set up around the country who take on that aspect of the work. but they don't necessarily have the ideas or the brilliant insight. So if you have an idea, then you should go and talk to somebody who runs or works in a trials unit. There are processes for accessing them, and I depend entirely on my network of colleagues. So when I need to do another 10,000 patient trial, I'm on the phone to David may be just about off the hook, but to all the people who've helped in the past, saying, do you think you could bear to do one more? Or preferably, do you have a young and upcoming person who wants to work with us, who wants to take a lead for a country, you know, for Northern Ireland, for wherever it is, and actually get involved? I think it's very difficult to set up a trials unit and run it all by yourself. I don't think that's ever going to happen again. But you can get involved, and if you find it's what you want to do, and you get exposure on the international circuit, then it's quite possible to make a very good career of it. It's not an isolated issue. And the other example, of course, is genetics now. Is genetics never took off until the geneticists started talking to each other. And now the networks are global, as you know. They basically pool everything because that's the only way they can get the power. So that's another good example where the networking makes it happen. But the brilliance of clinical trials is it starts in the clinic. I still do clinic, and that's still where you get the suggestion. You see the patient that doesn't quite fit, something odd, you know. You give them a drug and their glucose goes the wrong way. And so that starts the question mulling over in your mind. And from there, you set up the paradigm you want to test. And then if you're lucky, you get a friendly trials unit to help you with it. And then if you're right, it's fantastic. If not, then you're back to the drawing board.
Here. Thanks very much. Roy, you've shown us convincing evidence that intervention with glucose lowering seems to confer little benefit to the already had a coronary, which is an interesting contrast with the observation that intervention with antiplatelet therapy in the form of aspirin seems to have its greatest benefit in those who have had a coronary. Is that difference attributable to the different mechanisms of the two interventions at different phases in the evolution of arterial sclerosis, or does that have some other explanation?
I think you're right. It's the process. So for people with an acute myocardial infarction, we know, of course, that controlling glucose during that period of insult does bring benefits. So there's an acute impact of the dysmetabolism after an insult, and that's whether it's surgery, an MI, or being in an ICU. Although again, you've seen that with the recent trials where they tried to get glucoses down to completely normal levels, they actually got worsening. So the answer for acute MIs is modest glucose lowering to single digits of glucose between say 5 and 10 is the safest pathway. The problem for the long-term outcomes is that glucose, unlike blood pressure treatment, unlike cholesterol, unlike platelets, takes years to have its impact. We believe it's got to do with the advanced glycation products, the remodeling of the vasculature, and what you're in for the long haul. And once people have already got that atherosclerosis, undoing all those years of cross-linked collagen is really quite difficult. You chose aspirin. Aspirin works quite dramatically because, of course, the agonal event in a myocardial infarction is the thrombus formation, and that's where the platelet activity has its greatest impact, so you can get a quick and useful impact. Of course, we don't know about primary prevention with aspirin. That's another trial we're doing, but I won't stray into that just now.
Well, I think that's been really wonderful, and thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed.